Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this coming segment, or this segment, is For the Record program number 220, and I'm going to be updating a number of stories and dealing with a number of miscellaneous articles. There will be no united theme to this particular program. In For the Record broadcast number 212, I updated my program about Serpent's Walk. That's a Nazi track that I've dealt with for a long time, and it is, I believe, far more than the novel it purports to be. It's authored by a guy named Randolph, who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. It's published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance. It's about a Nazi takeover in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS who go underground, build up their economic muscle, buy into the American opinion-forming media, and after an attack by genetically engineered microorganisms of apparently Russian origin, which wipes out much of the Earth's population, much of the American population, including the president and vice president, the Speaker of the House becomes president and invites the underground Reich into a governing coalition. I believe that just as the Turner Diaries, the novel authored by Andrew MacDonald, the pen name for William Luther Pierce, is far more than the novel it purports to be. It appears to be a blueprint and a manifesto for contemporary Nazi organizations. So, too, I believe the book Serpent's Walk is far more than just a novel. As I've stated so many times in the past, I believe it's a blueprint for what is happening and what is going to happen. In For the Record program number 212, Updating Serpent's Walk, I dealt with, among other things, the concept of a piggyback viruses of microorganisms that were going to be used to spread the devastating Pakov virus, which wipes out much of the American and world population. In that novel, actually, it's Pakov wipes out much of the population of Asia and Africa, and then another virus, Starock, or another organism, Starock, wipes out much of the American population. But there's discussion in Serpent's Walk of the Pakov, the genetically engineered Pakov bug, being piggybacked onto other viruses. And in For the Record programs 198 and 199, I dealt with an article that is an expose of the SV40 cancer-causing monkey virus that in turn we've dealt with in many of the broadcasts with Ed Haslam, the author of the extremely important recent book Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, published in softcover by Wordsworth Press and copyright 1995. In For the Record program 198, we visited with Ed Haslam once again, a person who's graced our airwaves many times in the past, and in that incredibly important book about Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, Ed deals with the SV40, a cancer-causing monkey virus that is a contaminant of vaccines. It contaminated the polio vaccine in the period 55 to 63 and still appears to be a major vaccine contaminant in that the screening procedures used to eliminate it are, at least up until, or have been up until recently, antiquated. The SV40 cancer-causing monkey virus produces an oncogenic protein called large T antigen, which is devastating to human health. It causes cancer in a number of different ways. It causes cancer by producing a number of different effects, one of the most important of which is decommissioning the P53 gene. That's a gene which causes cells to commit suicide if there is genetic damage during the course of mitosis, cellular reproduction. That process is called apoptosis. If the P53 gene is decommissioned, then one of the body's major checks to see to it that there isn't cellular damage and resulting cancer is decommissioned. As we looked at in For the Record program 212, another virus that decommissions the P53 gene is the adenovirus, the virus that causes the common cold. And genetic engineering has been focused on the adenovirus for quite some time, looking at the adenovirus as a vehicle for what is known as gene therapy, namely trafficking genetic material into cells for therapeutic results. As we've noted in past discussion, the distinction between offensive and defensive biological warfare is academic. If you're doing research into how we beasties infect and kill people, then offensive and defensive research are the same thing. I would note that gene therapy could also be used for gene warfare. And as noted in numerous broadcasts, there is a considerable degree of overlap between not only the National Cancer Institute, but other organizations involved in the manufacture of vaccines and medicines, and the biological warfare establishment of this and other countries. In particular, many of our discussions with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, nature, accident, or intentional. We've explored that at considerable length. We also explored it at considerable length in RFA 16, AIDS, epidemic or weapon of war, recorded in April of 1986. Bearing in mind some of my hypothetical ruminations in For the Record Program 212 about Serpent's Walk and about the P53 gene and the possibility of genetically engineering an adenovirus to destroy the P53 gene and make people vulnerable to cancer, and the implications that could have for a Serpent's Walk scenario or sort of a do-it-yourself bio-Auschwitz in which an environment loaded with carcinogens would be a device that would overwhelm the immune systems of people. And if their P53 gene was wiped out, the other immunological checks against cancer would prove vain and they would die of cancer. In turn, I do recall what we've discussed with Ed Haslam in the past, namely that what appears to have been the focal point of the work of Dr. Mary Sherman and her colleagues, namely using a linear accelerator to mutate SV40 to produce a cancer vaccine, a vaccine against the cancers caused by SV40, that research ultimately fell into the hands of the murderous fascists who were behind the assassination of President Kennedy. That would include the Underground Reich. I wonder, and this is pure rumination, I wonder if just such a vaccine was developed, it would be a marvelous device for sort of a do-it-yourself bio-Auschwitz or a do-it-yourself, not do-it-yourself, but a slow-motion Serpent's Walk or bio-genocide scenario. Fill the environment full of carcinogens. That has been done. Spread around a genetically engineered adenovirus, which would decommission the P53 gene, vaccinate those people that you want to survive, and let everybody else die of cancer. I sure hope that I am full of it, but I'm afraid that such a thing might be a reality. Certainly, food for thought and grounds for further research in a very, very unappetizing fare, very, very unappetizing fare that is. Now, in connection with and in supplement to For the Record Program 212 and the other broadcasts on these related subjects, we're going to turn to the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, March 29th of the year 2000. This is an article by Robert Langreth, L-A-N-G-R-E-T-H, of the Wall Street Journal. It is headlined, Virus Revives Hopes for Gene Therapy. Subtitled, Primitive AAV Shows Promise as a Safer Means to Carry Healthy Genes into Body. The article reads in part as follows. An apparently harmless virus that's shaped like a soccer ball may give a boost to the beleaguered field of gene therapy. Since researchers began injecting patients with new genes to replace damaged ones about a decade ago, their biggest challenger has been devising a delivery vehicle that is safe, capable of bearing sufficient quantities of healthy genes, and able to target specific parts of the body. Last year's death of a young man from Arizona, Jesse Gelsinger, in a University of Pennsylvania gene therapy experiment, highlighted the potential danger of one of the most commonly used means of delivery, adenovirus, a genetically engineered form of the cold virus. Attacked by the body's immune system, adenovirus causes side effects that are usually temporary flu-like symptoms. In the Gelsinger case, however, the side effects fatally crippled the patient's lungs. Mr. Gelsinger's death brought about a regulatory crackdown, including stricter oversight of gene therapy experiments at the University of Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But it also sparked a race to create gene delivery vehicles that don't provoke an immune response. And skipping down, one of the companies involved in this research will ring unhappily familiar to veteran listeners to the program. Some scientists argue that none of the existing gene therapy technologies are yet ready for prime time. Merck and Company, for example, has spent years trying to perfect a gene delivery approach involving an improved, second-generation adenovirus, but the company has decided against patient tests soon. Merck is, of course, not only the company that made the experimental hepatitis B vaccine that is deeply implicated in the probably deliberate spread of AIDS, certainly the man-made spread of AIDS and the almost certain deliberate spread of AIDS. Merck is also a company with a long history of involvement with the biological warfare establishment in this country. And a closely related German firm, Merck, is one of the major German pharmaceutical firms as well. for a bit of review about the history of the Merck company with biological warfare and its involvement in the hepatitis B vaccine that is implicated in the spread of AIDS, probably deliberate, we're going to turn once again to the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident or Intentional, authored by Dr. Leonard G. Horowitz, published in hardcover by Tetrahedron Incorporated, and copyright 1996. Emerging Viruses, there is a section of a history that was official history issued by Fort Detrick, which is the military's top chemical and biological warfare research facility in this country. Its molecular oncology lab, Fort Detrick, I should say, mostly, except for a section of Fort Detrick that remains under the control of the military, the Army's Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. Fort Detrick was turned over in 1971 to the National Cancer Institute, and it became its molecular oncology laboratory, but in turn that facility was managed for the National Cancer Institute by Litton Bionetics, a wholly owned genetic engineering subsidiary of Litton Industries, a major defense contractor, and one that was deeply involved in biological warfare research. And the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer research program appears to have been the vehicle for the creation of AIDS. Again, this is discussed in Emerging Viruses and in many of our interviews with Dr. Leonard Horowitz. Of the history of Merck with biological warfare and its involvement with the hepatitis B vaccine, we read as follows in Emerging Viruses by Dr. Leonard Horowitz. And speaking of this history of Fort Detrick, writing the author's name was Covert, ironically enough. Covert wrote, "From the moment of its birth in the highest levels of government, the fledgling biological warfare effort was kept to an inner circle of knowledgeable persons. George W. Merck was a key member of the panel advising President Franklin D. Roosevelt and was charged with putting such an effort together. Merck owned the pharmaceutical firm that still bears his name." Skipping down. "My surprise was based on the knowledge that the hepatitis B vaccine Strecker alleged infected the American gay community was almost certainly manufactured by Merck's company. To confirm my suspicions, I dug out the New England Journal of Medicine report that I had studied years earlier. The paper reported that, indeed, the homosexual hepatitis B vaccine study had been supported, quote, by a grant from the Department of Virus and Cell Biology of Merck Sharp and Dohme Research Laboratories, West Point, Pennsylvania." And again, Merck, a name that will ring ominously familiar to veteran listeners to this program, deeply involved with genetic engineering of the adenovirus, which decommissions the P53 gene. One wonders whether perhaps Merck was involved with more than just laboratory testing. They certainly appear to have been in the past. Let's hope that the past is not prologue in this particular consideration. We're going to revisit a subject that we've looked at quite a few times over the years, starting with a 1988 miscellaneous archive show entitled Euthanasia in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany. And we've also revisited this subject in some interviews with Wesley J. Smith, the author of the book Forced Exit, about the official killing culture that is growing, basically the euthanasia movement, the right to die movement. And again, there are a number of interviews with Wesley J. Smith and those on the subject of his book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Legalized Suicide or from Legalized Murder. Oh, anyway, I've forgotten the subtitle of the book off the top of my head, but the book is again Forced Exit by Wesley J. Smith. In an update to the evolution of the right to die movement and the euthanasia movement, we find the following, which is an op-ed column by Wesley J. Smith in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 16th of the year 2000. Wesley J. Smith is described here as an attorney for the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force, and he has a new book, The Culture of Death, The Destruction of Medical Ethics in America, that is going to be coming out in September and published by Encounter Books. And again, his book Forced Exit, about the euthanasia movement, published by New York Times Books and about the right to die movement, is a very, very important work. And there are a number of interviews with Wesley available from Spitfire. This article is about the euthanasia law that passed in Oregon and how it continues to be abused. This op-ed column is entitled by the Chronicle, Caring, Not Killing, is the answer to serious illness. And again, it's from the Chronicle of Thursday, March 16th of the year 2000. The article reads as follows, or the op-ed column reads as follows. The assisted suicide charade in Oregon continues unabated. The newest installment is a report published in the February 24th New England Journal of Medicine that purports to tell the complete tale of the second full year of legalized assisted suicide. It doesn't. The report is more notable for what it omits than what it includes. Moreover, despite the energetic attempts by its Oregon Health Division authors to cast assisted suicide in a benign light, the report demonstrates powerfully that assisted suicide is bad medicine and even worse, public policy. There were 27 reported legal assisted suicides in Oregon in 1999, up from 15 in 1998, nearly double the first year's toll. That does not mean that there were only 27 such killings, as the report itself admits, quote, underreporting cannot be assessed, and noncompliance is difficult to assess, unquote. The reason for this is that there are no meaningful protections for suicidal terminally ill patients in Oregon. No physician has to report a potential assisted suicide before it happens. No efforts need to be made at suicide prevention. No family members have to be informed of a pending assisted suicide. No physician needs to be present when the patient swallows prescribed poison. Indeed, the only, quote, investigation, unquote, into these deaths is a review of paperwork filled out by the legally prescribing doctors and talks with family members referred by these same doctors, all after the patient is dead. The report claims that the primary reasons people committed legal assisted suicide in Oregon in 1999 remained consistent from the reasons reported for 1998, fear of losing autonomy, and the ability to engage in enjoyable activities. While seven of the dead patients feared receiving inadequate pain control, apparently none of the patients killed themselves because of uncontrollable pain, the supposed reason for legalizing assisted suicide in the first place. Nearly half chose death for fear of being a burden on their families. Thus, rather than being an act of last resort, unquote, when proper treatment doesn't work, as the law was sold to Oregon voters, assisted suicide is becoming an alternative to proper treatment. An analysis of the sporadic news reports about actual assisted suicides in Oregon indicate that most lethal prescriptions are being issued by a small cadre of doctors closely associated with assisted suicide advocacy groups. This suspicion is heightened by the report's admission that 18 of the dead patients went to two or more doctors before finding a doctor willing to prescribe lethal drugs, and that the patient-physician relationship with these doctors was as short as 2 weeks. Tellingly, the medical journal's authors did not bother to learn these connections, nor did the authors bother to interview the doctors who refused to prescribe suicide about why they would not help kill their patients. These unasked questions speak volumes about the intent of the report. Because of news coverage, we know of several very disturbing Oregon-assisted suicides, none of which are mentioned in the article. For example, we know that doctors are assisting suicides for patients with diseases outside of their specialty. We also know that family pressures have been involved in at least one case, that of a cancer patient with early-stage dementia. According to the story in the Oregonian, a psychiatrist found that Kate Cheney, C-H-E-N-E-Y, did not fully understand the implications of her request for assisted suicide and worried that the death request reflected the agenda of Cheney's daughter. So the daughter convinced her mother's HMO to refer her to another psychologist who also had reservations but approved the assisted suicide. The report also did not discuss the Patrick Matheny case. Matheny, M-A-T-H-E-N-Y, was a man with Lou Gehrig's disease who received his poison via Federal Express. When he tried to swallow the pills, he apparently had such a difficult time that his brother-in-law had to, quote, help, unquote. As a consequence of the Matheny case, a deputy attorney general wrote an opinion letter stating that Oregon might have to provide, quote, reasonable accommodation, unquote, under the Americans with Disabilities Act for disabled patients who could not kill themselves, meaning that active killing by doctors may just be a lawsuit away in Oregon. Clearly, the truly compassionate answer to the difficulties of serious illness isn't killing, it is improved caring. But with all of the hype over assisted suicide, it is difficult to get the facts about hospice and palliative care out to the general public. The deficiency will change when we finally turn our back on the assisted suicide movement's unfortunate death agenda. And again, Wesley Smith's previous book, by the way, he's co-authored a number of different books, including four titles co-authored with consumer advocate Ralph Nader. Wesley Smith's previous work, Forced Exit, is a book that I emphatically recommend for those who think that the Right to Die movement is about compassion and that it's about freedom. It's about neither. It's about getting rid of inconvenient bodies. And bear in mind that euthanasia was the beginning of the Nazi Holocaust in Germany under Hitler, and that the Nazi eugenics laws that ultimately gave rise to the Holocaust were in turn based on eugenics laws that were not only enacted here in the United States, or to a certain extent at least, enacted here in the United States, but they were the outgrowth of eugenics thinking that is very much au courant in the United States today. Witness the popularity of the book The Bell Curve, the racist bestseller based on eugenics research, and absolutely fascistic eugenics research. Again, author Wesley Smith, who wrote this article, has a forthcoming book entitled The Culture of Death, The Destruction of Medical Ethics in America. It'll be out in September, published by Encounter Books, and there are interviews with Wesley Smith about Forced Exit, available from Spitfire. So please pay close attention to the Right to Die movement. It is a very, very, very important subject, and one that is getting sadly undercovered. Again, we're dealing with miscellaneous articles and miscellaneous subjects. There was a very interesting column in, actually not a column, but an article in the New York Times of Saturday, March 18th of the year 2000. This is a book review. It's by Lawrence Zuckerman, and it's about a book entitled The Cultural War, The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters. This particular book review is entitled by the New York Times, How the CIA Played Dirty Tricks with Culture. Again, it's authored by Lawrence Zuckerman, and it reads in part as follows. Many people remember reading George Orwell's Animal Farm in high school or college, with its chilling finale in which the farm animals looked back and forth at the tyrannical pigs and the exploitative human farmers, but found it, quote, impossible to say which was which, unquote. That ending was altered in the 1955 animated version, which removed the humans, leaving only the nasty pigs. Another example of Hollywood butchering great literature? Yes, but in this case, the film's secret producer was the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA, it seems, was worried that the public might be too influenced by Orwell's pox on both their houses critique of the capitalist humans and communist pigs. So after his death in 1950, agents were dispatched by none other than E. Howard Hunt, later of Watergate fame, to buy the film rights to Animal Farm from his widow to make its message more overtly anti-communist. Rewriting the end of Animal Farm is just one example of the often absurd lengths to which the CIA went, as recounted in a new book, The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, The New Press by Francis Stoner Saunders, a British journalist. Published in Britain last summer, the book will appear here next month. Much of what Ms. Stoner Saunders writes about, including the CIA's covert sponsorship of the Paris-based Congress for Cultural Freedom and the British opinion magazine Encounter, was exposed in the late 1960s, generating a wave of indignation. But by combing through archives and unpublished manuscripts and interviewing several of the principal actors, Ms. Stoner Saunders has uncovered many new details and gives the most comprehensive account yet of the agency's activities between 1947 and 1967. This picture of the CIA's secret war of ideas has cameo appearances by scores of intellectual celebrities like the critics Dwight MacDonald and Lionel Trilling, the poets Ted Hughes and Derek Walcott, and the novelists James Michener and Mary McCarthy, all of whom directly or indirectly benefited from the CIA's largesse. So please note the influence of the Central Intelligence Agency, not only in the news media per se, but also in cultural events. And note also the following. This is an op-ed column from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, March 27th of the year 2000. This is by Alexander Coburn. It's headlined, Today's News is Brought to You by Big Brother, subtitled The Media. It is shocking that CNN allowed five members of an Army PSYOPs unit to work in its news headquarters. This article reads in part as follows. A handful of military personnel from the 4th Psychological Operations Group based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, have until recently been working in CNN's headquarters in Atlanta. An enterprising Dutch journalist named Abe de Vries came up with this important story in mid-February, and he remains properly astounded that no mainstream news medium in the U.S. has evinced any interest in it. I came across translations of de Vries' stories after they had appeared in late February in Trouw, T-R-O-U-W, the foremost newspaper in Holland. De Vries later told me he'd originally come upon the story in the French newspaper Intelligence Online, available on a pay-per-story basis. February 17th, which described a military symposium in Arlington, Virginia that discussed the use of the press in military operations. A Colonel Christopher St. John, commander of the U.S. Army's 4th PSYOPS Group, was quoted by intelligence's correspondent present at the symposium as, in the correspondent's words, having called for greater cooperation between the armed forces and media giants. He, St. John, pointed out that some Army PSYOPS personnel had worked for CNN for several weeks and helped in the production of some news stories for the network, unquote. Reading this in Belgrade, where he's Truo's correspondent, de Vries saw a good story, picked up the phone, and finally reached Major Thomas Collins of the U.S. Army Information Service, who duly confirmed the presence of these Army PSYOP experts at CNN. PSYOPs personnel, soldiers, and officers, de Vries quoted Collins as telling him, have been working at CNN's headquarters in Atlanta through our program, Training with Industry. They worked as regular employees of CNN. They helped in the production of news, unquote. I reported this interesting disclosure in Counterpunch a couple of weeks ago and made it the topic of my regular weekly broadcast to AM Live, a program of the South Africa Broadcasting Company in Johannesburg. Among the audience of this broadcast was CNN's bureau in South Africa, which lost no time in relaying news to CNN headquarters in Atlanta, and I duly received an angry phone call from Eason Jordan, who identified himself as CNN's president of news gathering and international networks. Jordan was full of indignation that I had somehow compromised the reputation of CNN. Well, this type of thing is unfortunately anything but unusual. Not only the military, but the CIA has been involved with the news media as well as cultural events. Turning back to the article from the New York Times of Saturday, March 18th of the year 2000, the Lawrence Zuckerman article, How the CIA Played Dirty Tricks with Culture, there is this quote about the CIA's involvement in the media. If the other side can use ideas that are camouflaged as being local rather than Soviet-supported or simulated, then we ought to be able to use ideas camouflaged as local ideas. Tom Braden, who ran the CIA's covert cultural division in the early 1950s, explained years later. In one of the book's many amusing codas, Mr. Braden goes on in the 1980s to become the leftist foil to Patrick Buchanan on the CNN program Crossfire, unquote. So do take what one reads and sees with a grain of salt. That concludes For the Record program number 220. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.